And it's time for Evening Under Lamplight as we take our seats for what's ahead this time. You're under lamplight? Good. Here, too, we're under lamplight. It's always important in the studio for me to turn on the two lamps as I give a grateful wave goodbye to Kipper the cat and his henchmen. Off now into the evening under streetlight or something like that. Actually, it's full moon. I should have done a show about the full moon. I've never done that before, but I won't. You never know when you're going to listen to this. If it's not a full moon, there's no point. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and I invite you to attend to this week's selection of music and words here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. You can reach me, by the way, at rla@momentsunderlamplight.com or on Facebook, and archives of this show and previous shows are waiting for you at momentsunderlamplight.com. Lots of goodies at that site, in fact. We often attend here at Evening Under Lamplight to the change of seasons. It keeps us grounded. And there's a delight in observing each moment in each season, realizing that this moment is just part of the ongoing, changeful process, the cycle over and over. We'll be talking more about that ongoing process later in the show, in fact, or rather, Walt Whitman will be. And the season is changing quite noticeably at the moment. Hey, it's only early September, but already many trees, at least in our village of Linton, are changing colour, and a few beech trees are standing in a puddle of fallen leaves, the branches almost bare. What's going on? It's only early September. Well, I'm not sure it's our task to analyse what's going on, just to be mindful of it. The sun comes to us from a different slant, too, mellow and golden both in its morning light and its late afternoon glow. I think first I want to share a Kinks song, one we played before several years ago at this season. The song's called Summer's Gone, from the 1984 album Word of Mouth, not one of the Kinks' most celebrated albums, but full of good tracks. The song takes the end of summer as an image of the passing of time, with Ray Davies' usual complex emotional engagement, a little panicked by anything that hints of change or that reminds him of the past. Looking in a window on a rainy day, thinking about good things that I just threw away, looking at the gutter, watching the trash go flowing by, thinking it's summer, but there are only clouds in the sky. It's still summer, but his heart is weighed down with regret. His eyes are looking down at the trash in the gutter, floating along in the gushing rainwater. It's harvest time, but for Ray, all the summer has produced is waste. When I think of what we wasted makes me sad. We never appreciated what we had. Now I'm standing in a doorway with my overcoat on. It really feels like summer's gone. It should have been a laugh. It should have been fun. When I think of all the things that we did last summer, now I look back, it seems such a crime. We couldn't appreciate it at the time. And I think when he says we couldn't appreciate it at the time, he doesn't just mean him and whoever he's been spending the summer with. He means all of us. None of us appreciates it at the time. Well, that's not news. Now I'm standing in a doorway, thinking of summers gone by. It's not enough just to think of this one wasted summer. He thinks of all wasted summers gone by. Now I'm standing in a doorway thinking of summers gone by. It ought to make me happy, but it just makes me cry. Veyes mir. But the song shifts to a familiar little vignette from childhood. Kids in the back seat of the car annoying dad at the wheel. And then we're projected into the mind of the father, who is as baffled at life as anyone else, and is soon to have it all pass by. I was riding in the car with my mum and dad. He was driving the car. The kids were driving him mad. Dad looked at us, then he looked at his wife. He must have wondered where we all came from. And then mum said, "Dad, you know it won't last for long. Before you know it, summer's gone." See how long it takes for the jaunty, upbeat tone of the music to turn sour and tug at our heart. That was the Kinks' Summer's Gone, ending with thunder and a kind of insane nonsense and a few seagulls reminding us of the seaside from that summer that's gone. But there's more to this time of the year than just the end of summer. In the ancient Chinese calendar, we are entering the time of the fifth season, not summer, not autumn, but that in-between time harvest. You know I often bring in at such times one of the meditations from my CD Journey Through the Seasons, Meditations on the Five Chinese Healing Energies. I don't do this as a kind of self-promotion, but from the urge just to share with you some further thoughts I have on the topic. This meditation features poetry by Emily Dickinson, John Keats, and Wendell Berry, and the music is by Neil Henry. Harvest. As imperceptibly as grief, the summer lapsed away. Too imperceptible at last to seem like perfidy. A quietness distilled as twilight long begun, or nature spending with herself sequestered afternoon. The dusk drew earlier in, the morning foreign shone, a courteous yet harrowing grace as guest that would be gone. And thus, without a wing or service of a keel, our summer made her light escape into the beautiful. Finally, we move to the season of harvest, the color yellow, or better, the color of golden wheat. The element is the earth. Here, we're grounded, earthed at the end of the journey. The organ is the spleen, the minister of the granary, extracting nourishment from our food. All the energy of the seasons has led us here. Now is the time for feeding, for quiet enjoyment of all that is good, solid, and nourishing. The negative emotion in this season is worry, as we become anxious about whether there might be enough to sustain us. We still find it hard to trust that energy that has led us this far along our path. Will there be enough? Will we be all right here at the end of the journey? The positive emotions are serenity and compassion. That peaceful calm when we can let go and put our trust in whatever harvest comes our way. We know that at the deepest levels we are always nourished. We accept the blessing of ripeness. All is now ready. Season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines that round the thatch eaves run, to bend with apples the mossed cottage trees and fill all fruit with ripeness to the core. To swell the gourd and plump the hazel shells with a sweet kernel. To set budding more and still more later flowers for the bees until they think warm days will never cease, for summer has o'erbrimmed their clammy cells. Who hath not seen thee oft amid thy store? Sometimes whoever seeks abroad may find thee sitting careless on a granary floor, thy hair soft lifted by the winnowing wind. Or on a half-reaped furrow sound asleep, drowsed with the fume of poppies, while thy hook spares the next swath and all its twined flowers. And sometimes, like a gleaner, thou dost keep steady thy laden head across a brook. Or by a cider press, with patient look, thou watchest the last oozings, hours by hours. Where are the songs of spring? Aye, where are they? Think not of them, thou hast thy music too. While barred clouds bloom the soft dying day and touch the stubble plains with rosy hue. Then in a wailful choir the small gnats mourn among the river sallows, borne aloft or sinking as the light wind lives or dies. And full-grown lambs loud bleat from hilly bourn. Hedge crickets sing, and now with treble soft the redbreast whistles from a garden croft, and gathering swallows twitter in the skies. And there we end, all fruit with ripeness to the core, completed in our very center, where, as the fruit of our alchemy, lie the male and female, sun and moon, together in serenity. In spring we planted seed, and by degrees the plants grew, flowered, and transformed the light to food, which we brought in and ate and lived. The year grown old, we gathered all that remained. We broke, manured, prepared the ground for overwintering. And thus at last made clear our little plot of time, tropical for a while, then temperate, then cold. And so the journey finishes and moves on, tropical, temperate, then cold. In my end is my beginning. There was the harvest meditation from Journey Through the Seasons. I don't believe the website for the CD is still active, but if you're interested in the CD, get in touch with me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.com. I've not done this before, but I thought it would be nice to spend a little more time with one of the poems in that meditation, Emily Dickinson's poem, As Imperceptibly as Grief. First, let's hear the poem again. As imperceptibly as grief, the summer lapsed away, too imperceptible at last to seem like perfidy. A quietness distilled as twilight long begun, or nature spending with herself sequestered afternoon. The dusk drew earlier in, the morning foreign shone, a courteous yet a harrowing grace as guest that would be gone. And thus, without a wing or service of a keel, our summer made her light escape into the beautiful. Dickinson's poems look simple at first, but as soon as we stop to attend, they baffle us with their murkiness and ambiguity. As imperceptibly as grief, the summer lapsed away. Huh? Does grief lapse away imperceptibly? Well, perhaps it does. We are grieving for some sort of loss. Life feels like it's not worth living and never again will be worth living. But then, a few weeks later, you see some four-year-old, entirely self-absorbed, lining up a row of stones on the pavement, and you smile. Or the driver of a car stops and motions you to go ahead across the street, and you almost smile as you wave your thanks. Then this almost smile comes again a few days later, and you notice that the brisk sunny weather has put a little bounce in your step. The grief is still there, but it is lapsing away, imperceptibly. So too, Dickinson says, so too does the summer lapse away. We still have dinner outside, but we suddenly realize that the sun's no longer in our eyes at the table, and one day we put on an extra layer before we sit down to eat. I'm speaking here of natural signs of summer's lapsing, the kind of signs Emily Dickinson and most people around her time would be thinking about. For those less in touch with the seasonal cycle, that is, most people today, perhaps things are more abrupt. A new sports season suddenly starts. Summer resorts shut down. School starts again. A new set of programs comes onto the television. And oh yes, of course, the Christmas ads start hitting us. Well, I'm sorry. For people living entirely in this world, the summer does not lapse imperceptibly, and they do not observe the change anyway. The change is announced to them by some broadcasted voice, or some flyer through the mail or something. Well, that's a shame. But we've moved away from the poem itself. This quiet lapsing of the summer, the poem says, is too imperceptible at last to seem like perfidy. There's no treason in this change of season. It doesn't come upon us like a sudden betrayal. There's no perfidy. In fact, no sharp emotions at all. It's a quietness distilled, the essence of quietness. It's distilled. There's the word still inside, distilled. There's all sorts of word plays always with Emily Dickinson. And we have two similes. As twilight long begun, a long lingering twilight, as sunset slowly, imperceptibly is distilled, refined into night. That's what this change of season can be likened to. Or nature spending with herself sequestered afternoon. Here's a picture of nature, some motherly figure perhaps, retiring into a private room or to a rocking chair on an unoccupied veranda to pass long, quiet hours before dinner, just sitting, reminiscing or daydreaming without any disturbances. There's a whole drama being painted for us if we can pause to attend to it. And the light. The dusk drew earlier in. The morning foreign shone. How does the morning shine foreign? It feels different. It feels like it doesn't really belong here with us, this misty early morning or this sudden sharp light. There's a courteous yet harrowing grace. Courteous, there's nothing rude or intrusive about it, and yet it is harrowing. It rips into us. As guest that would be gone. A lovely image of a guest who knows he or she doesn't belong here and wants to leave but is too courteous to come out and say this, so lingers on a little while longer. The poem has given us all these images of lingering, of not quite standing still but moving on so gradually we are aware of no emotion. Without a wing that is not like a bird slowly flying off into the distant sky, and without service of a keel, that is not like a boat quietly pushing out into the water and gliding into the distance. No, not that way, but yes, sort of like that way, as our summer, we're all in this together, notice, our summer made her light escape, moved away like the bird into the distant sky, or the boat out into the bay, but not into the sky or into the water's horizon, but simply into the beautiful. Into something far too uncertain, too imperceptible to be given a concrete image, just that wonderful abstraction of the beautiful. The summer's light escape, light not just in the sense of not weighing too heavily on us, but in the sense of being perceptible, if at all, only through the play of light, sun or shade, lingering dusk, the beautiful spirit of the atmosphere. As imperceptibly as grief, the summer lapsed away, too imperceptible at last to seem like perfidy. A quietness distilled as twilight long begun, or nature spending with herself sequestered afternoon. The dusk drew earlier in, the morning foreign shone, a courteous yet harrowing grace, a guest that would be gone. And thus, without a wing or service of a keel, our summer made her light escape into the beautiful.
Thank you.
I hope you liked the way we followed Emily Dickinson's As Imperceptibly as Grief, with Duo Dolan playing Fauré's Après un rêve, After a Dream, as though wondering whether that summer might, after all, have been just a dream. You're listening, as you probably know, to Evening Under Lamplight with Robert Louis Abrahamson on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Now, I've spoken before about audiobooks and about how useful I have always found them. They keep us company when we're cleaning the place or driving in the car, though we have to be careful not to get too absorbed in the story. I once stopped the car and looked around to find myself on a small country road with no idea where I was on the physical plane. On the imaginative level, I was right there with Emma Bovary in Normandy, but I had no idea of my surroundings. It's a little dangerous. We can get absorbed like this in stories and biographies, but then there are those audiobooks that don't rely on plot, books we can dip into anywhere. Poetry is like that, especially poetry we know well. Then we can play the audiobook when lying awake at 2:30 in the morning, listening and dozing and listening, catching what we can as the phrases enter our imagination even below the level of consciousness. Emily Dickinson is someone I especially recommend for audio listening. Hearing the poems over and over, sometimes attending carefully, sometimes letting the lines just work their way into us, can result in many phrases just becoming part of us. And if we're good at it, we find ourselves having memorized many of the poems without being aware of it. There are several readings of Dickinson's poems, but the one I go back to and recommend to you is by Teresa Gallagher, who'd charmed me a year or two ago reading Esther Summerson's chapters in Bleak House. The Emily Dickinson album says it is unabridged, but how can that be? The audiobook is only an hour and 16 minutes long, but Dickinson wrote 1,775 poems, 1775 poems, coming to over 700 pages in the Faber edition. This audiobook is obviously only a selection, but an unabridged selection, whatever that might mean. Anyway, it's published by Naxos, by far the most reliable publisher of audiobooks. I can't think of any of their audiobooks that has not pleased me. And I recommend you think about buying your audiobooks from audible.co.uk or audible.com in America. You can download them as soon as you buy them if you're feeling impatient to hear these voices. Better yet, subscribe to Audible. I have a monthly account for which I pay £7.99 a month and receive one credit. That's not a bad deal, since that credit can pay for even very expensive audiobooks. The Naxos recording of Dickens' Bleak House, for instance, unabridged, read excellently by Sean Barrett and Teresa Gallagher, costs £32, but I got it for only one credit. That is, over 35 hours of reading for only £7.99. The wonderful Jim Norton reading of Joyce's Ulysses, essential for enjoying the flavour of the novel, costs over £46, but again, counts as only one credit, so I got it for only £7.99. This is not an ad for Audible, just a tribute and a recommendation of something you might find as rewarding as I do. But in fact, if you're interested, and you get 1 month's free audiobook as a trial offer, you can go to Audible via the link on the mindrollingpodcast.com website. mindrollingpodcast.com. I've told you about Mind Rolling Podcast before, and if you click onto Audible from the Mind Rolling site, you'll be helping out this important podcast. And also, if you haven't met them already, you can make the acquaintance of Raghu Marcus and David Silver and sign up for their weekly free podcast. Well, I spoke a few weeks ago about another of the audiobooks I've picked up from Audible, John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, read very well by John Chancer. I've been portioning out my listening to this novel, not wanting the experience to end. And I have two more passages to share with you here. I'll not give you the audiobook version, but my own, if only for technical reasons, which I won't go into right now. One reason I'm sharing these two passages is that it's been a tough summer. Intractable and dangerous hatred arising in so many places, but also a strong, though not always powerful, response by sane and compassionate people. What do we make of all this? How does it make sense? Steinbeck was grappling with equally oppressive and puzzling issues in The Grapes of Wrath. The rich were grabbing all they could among the small farmers in America in the 1930s, and all the old values seemed to be losing their hold. The Joad family, having lost their farm, are all piled in a beat-up old truck, with all that's left of their possessions, heading to California for work. Not long on their journey, Grandpa dies, a feisty old man whose dirty old mind and worn-out old body couldn't handle this uprooting from the land he'd known all his life. The family cannot afford a funeral. They cannot even afford to notify the officials about Grandpa's death. So they bury him on the side of the road, and they ask Casey to say a few words. Casey is a former preacher who's traveling with them and who stands for Steinbeck's own voice in the book. Casey no longer believes in the old religion. He's just a figuring things out as he goes. But he knows that all faith must encompass a love and respect for all people. Here's the scene of Grandpa's funeral off the side of the road at night. The firelight fell on the grouped people, showing their faces and their eyes, dwindling on their dark clothes. All the hats were off now. The light danced, jerking over the people. Casey said, "It'll be a short one." He bowed his head and the others followed his lead. Casey said solemnly, "This here old man just lived a life and just died out of it. I don't know whether he was good or bad, but that don't matter much. He was alive, and that's what matters. And now he's dead, and that don't matter. Heard a fellow one time tell a poem, and he says, 'All that lives is holy.' Got to thinking, and pretty soon it means more than the word says. And I wouldn't pray for an old fellow that's dead. He's all right. He got a job to do, but it's all laid out for him, and there's only one way to do it. But us, we got a job to do, and they's a thousand ways, and we don't know which one to take. And if I was to pray, it'd be the folks that don't know which way to turn. Grandpa here, he got the easy straight, and I'll cover him up and let him get to his work." And that's it. The simple way to face the painful mysteries. All that lives is holy, and let's get on with trying to help that holiness in each other. A little later, the older daughter, Rose of Sharon, 17 years old and 7 or 8 months pregnant, is sitting with her mother in the tent, camped on the roadside, while now it's Grandma who's dying. The two women are fanning the flies away from Grandma's face while Grandma mutters incoherently in delirium. Rose of Sharon looked helplessly at the old woman. She said softly, "She's awful sick." Ma raised her eyes to the girl's face. Ma's eyes were patient, but the lines of strain were on her forehead. Ma fanned and fanned the air, and her piece of cardboard warned off the flies. "When you're young, Rosa Sharn, everything that happens is a thing all by itself. It's a lonely thing." "I know. I remember, Rosa Sharn." Her mouth loved the name of her daughter. "You're going to have a baby, Rosa Sharn, and that's something to you lonely in a way. That's going to hurt you, and the hurt will be a lonely hurt, and this here tent is alone in the world, Rosa Sharn." She wiped the air for a moment to drive a buzzing blowfly on, and the big, shining flies circled the tent twice and zoomed out into the blinding sunlight, and Ma went on, "There's a time of change, and when that comes, dying is a piece of all dying. And barren is a piece of all barren, and barren and dying is two pieces of the same thing. And then things ain't lonely anymore. Rose of Sharon, I wished I could tell you so you'd know, but I can't." And her voice was so soft, so full of love, The tears crowded into Rose of Sharon's eyes and flowed over her eyes and blinded her. That was Miriam Makeba, We Speak Peace. We speak peace to you, O Bawo, we speak peace to you. Through the sweat beads of your labor, we speak to you. They've tried to take your dignity in a place you can't call home. Here's the song of reaching out to all people, especially those like the Jodes who are dispossessed and oppressed, trying to hold on to dignity in a place they can't call home. And the only way to keep that dignity is to keep in mind that our individual human feelings and activities are a part of all human feelings and activities. And then, as Ma tells Rose of Sharon, and then things ain't lonely anymore. And then a hurt don't hurt so bad, 'cause it ain't a lonely hurt no more. And now it's time for our fortnightly engagement with Walt Whitman. We're up to the sixth section of The Song of Myself, and as usual, we start off just listening to the lines. A child said, "What is the grass?" fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child, "I do not know what it is any more than he"? I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrance so designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name some way in the corners, that we may see and remark and say, whose? Or I guess the grass is itself a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. Or I guess it is a uniform hieroglyphic, and it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones. Growing among black folks as among white. Canuck, Tuckahoe, Congressman, Cuff, I give them the same, I receive them the same. And now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. Tenderly will I use you, curling grass. It may be you transpire from the breasts of young men. It may be if I had known them, I would have loved them. It may be you are from old people and from women and from offspring taken soon out of their mother's laps. And here you are the mother's laps. This grass is very dark to be from the white heads of old mothers, darker than the colorless beards of old men, dark to come from under the faint red roofs of mouths. Oh, I perceive, after all, so many uttering tongues, and I perceive they do not come from the roofs of mouths for nothing. I wish I could translate the hints about the dead young men and women and the hints about old men and mothers and the offspring taken soon out of their laps. And what do you think has become of the young and old men? And what do you think has become of the women and children? They are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death. And if ever there was, it led forward life and does not wait at the end to arrest it and cease the moment life appeared. All goes onward and outward, and nothing collapses. And to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. Well, the section begins with a question. A child said, "What is grass?" fetching it to me with full hands. And the rest of the section provides some sort of answer. But no definite answer, as we shall see. In the previous sections, Whitman has been putting us in touch with our soul, the me, myself, our true self, as opposed to the social self that is only our superficial persona or ego self. If a child comes to our ego self with a question like, "What is the grass?" we're likely to brush the question aside as irrelevant. "Don't bother me, Jimmy. I have more important things to do." Or give some sort of pat answer. "The grass, well, it's a plant that spreads across the ground, and cows and sheep eat it, and people use it for lawns. And that takes care of that." But Whitman, in touch with his true self, does not give that kind of response. He takes the question seriously and joins the child in wonder. Notice, by the way, that the child does not just ask the question, but actually fetches the grass with full hands. The exuberance of childlike wonder at the world. "Hey, Walt, look at this!" Touching the things he is asking about and smelling them, immersing himself in the things of the world. It's no abstract question. What is the grass? The question is really asking, what is it all about? What do I make of life? And the only answer the true self can offer is a series of guesses. Even though the true self is in touch with all, it is no expert. All it can offer is its own tentative perspective, or perspectives, since Whitman proceeds to offer a variety of different perspectives on what the grass seems to him. And automatically, it seems, Whitman assumes that the question does not ask what the grass is made of or what it is good for. He assumes the child is a poet, as he himself is a poet, and the question becomes a way of expressing the different metaphors we can find for the grass. Like the other American transcendentalists of his time, Whitman uncovers the truth by turning material phenomena into symbols, taking us to the higher levels. So, the first response from Whitman is to put himself on a par with the child, which means denying his ability to answer the question. How could I answer this child? I don't know what it is any more than he. And then come the series of guesses. First, I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. Okay, let's see the grass as a flag, that is, a symbol or emblem standing for my disposition. Green is the traditional color of hope, and I'm always hopeful. The green grass waving around is like my hopeful disposition. Is that a little too easy an answer? Whitman's breezy tone is going to be a problem here. He can seem too quick in throwing out his perceptions for us to take them seriously. But if we attend to the toughness of the language, we see that there's always something startling in what Whitman is saying that keeps the poetry from being too facile. Out of hopeful green stuff woven. That's a phrase that keeps reverberating in me. Green stuff? What kind of stuff? There's a casualness in this word stuff that reinforces Whitman's whole casual disposition. And yet, ending the phrase with woven, out of hopeful green stuff woven, gives it the feel of some old-fashioned, even biblical language, far from casual. There's a lot going on here. Then the next metaphor for the grass. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord. All these guesses. That's all we can do with metaphor. Just guess. This is not a science where we follow precise formulae. As T.S. Eliot famously said, all we can do with poetic language is offer hints and guesses. Hints followed by guesses. We're not confined to one answer. Only a scientist or a pedant has one answer. Each new guess gives us a new perspective, and the number of perspectives is limitless, and each one is valid. So let's go back to that handkerchief of the Lord. He supposes that it's a scented gift and remembrancer designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name some way in the corners, that we may see and remark and say whose. So, the grass becomes a metaphor for a handkerchief, embroidered with its owner's name or initial, dropped designedly to attract us. That used to be a game they played in the old days when men and women weren't allowed just to come up and talk to each other if they hadn't been introduced. The lady takes a fancy to the man, and as she passes him, say on her way out of the theater into her carriage, she just happens to drop her handkerchief, which just happens to have on it her name or her initials or her coat of arms. This gesture lets the man know she's interested in him and gives him a lead on how to follow up this unspoken invitation. And this grass as handkerchief, in turn, becomes the metaphor for some relationship the Lord has towards us. In fact, what Whitman is suggesting here is that God is a flirt. He drops grass all over the world to entice us to stop and look at it in wonder and seek out the owner. And that's what's called natural religion. All aspects of the natural world can lead us, if we look attentively, to a deeper understanding of God. Another guess. Or I guess the grass itself is a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. Yes, okay. Everything in nature comes from something else. The grass came from other grass. Therefore, it is a child of the grass, just as that human child asking the question is a child of humans. Well, okay. This one does feel a little too slick for me. Let's move on to the next guess. Or I guess it is a uniform hieroglyphic. That is, a kind of simple, holy writing. And it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks as among white. Canuck, Tuckahoe, Congressman, Cuff, I give them the same. I receive them the same. The grass growing everywhere becomes a symbol of the universality of people. No matter what our racial, ethnic, or social labels, we all walk on grass. We need to look up a few words that would have been common to Whitman's readers. Canuck is a French-Canadian. It's a derogatory term, but Whitman brushes this off. Others may call this person from Quebec a Canuck, but he's still my brother. A Tuckahoe is a person from the lowlands of Virginia, where the land is poor. It's another derogatory term for a group of people we look down on, but the grass doesn't mind that. A cuff or a cuffy was the name for a black person, probably as derogatory as the other ethnic names on this list. And then there's the congressman thrown into this list of scornful terms. Yes, the grass grows even among congressmen, odd as that might seem. And then it seems to me Whitman's tone changes, as though modulating to a minor key. There are no more upbeat, jovial metaphors, but a quieter, reverential awe. Listen to the quietness of this tender line. And now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. We didn't expect to be led here, did we? And of course the next word is tenderly, as for the first time Whitman addresses the grass itself. Tenderly will I use you, curling grass. Why? Because of the graves the grass is growing on. The whole earth is a graveyard. Who knows how many bodies have been buried ages and ages ago underneath the ground where we are standing or sitting right now? It may be you transpire from the breasts of young men. A gruesome image, perhaps. But the thought of young men awakens Whitman's compassion for all his brothers. It may be if I had known them, I would have loved them. And compassion, in fact, for everyone. It may be you're from old people and from women and from offspring taken soon out of their mother's laps, and here you are the mother's laps. Hallowed laps, which no longer hold the offspring taken soon. There is the dead mother buried underground. The earth piled above them is their laps, and also the grass growing on the earth. And there's the grotesque oddity of the grass as dark hair flowing from the white heads of old mothers and the colorless beards of old men is also oddly dark to come from under the faint red roofs of mouths. The tender tone has suddenly turned into a moment of horror. The grass, the grass growing up out of the skull that once held the faint red gums of a human mouth. Whitman startles us to keep us awake, to sustain our wonder. The idea of the grass coming out of the mouth leads to another perspective on the grass. Now it's a metaphor for the tongue. Oh, I perceive, after all, so many uttering tongues, and I perceive they do not come from the roofs of mouths for nothing. If the grass is a tongue, then it is speaking to us. But we're not sure what it is saying. I wish I could translate the hints about the dead young men and women, and the hints about old men and mothers, and the offspring taken soon out of their laps. What do you think has become of the young and old men? And what do you think has become of the women and children? Well, these are not just fruitless questions. The grass, in fact, can speak to us with some kind of answer. These people in the past died and have been buried, but their life has not come to an end. Out of their bodies has come new life in the form of this grass. And what becomes of death in this context? All these dead men and women and children are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death. And if ever there was, it led forward life and does not wait at the end to arrest it and cease the moment life appeared. Yes, as far as the ego is concerned, the dead body is dead. That's that. But the true self, the soul, sees the interrelationship between all things and perceives that one thing leads to another. It's what is sometimes called the chthonic mystery. We plant the seed in the earth, and the seed must die before the new plant takes life. Death becomes only the gateway to a new life. In a sense, though my body dies, I give it up so that some new life can proceed from it. My ego would rather not have it that way, but my soul knows it is not diminished by this passing on of life. All goes onward and outward, and nothing collapses, Whitman says, working up to his climax, one of the most outrageous lines in all of Whitman's poetry. And to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. Death, that great human misfortune, the thing we all dread, is lucky? What kind of jive is this, Whitman is throwing at us? Well, it's a paradox for us to ponder. If once we see death as different from what we supposed, then maybe there's a chance that we will indeed perceive that it's luckier than anything we supposed it to be. I'll read the whole section again, and then we'll finish our evening together here under lamplight. and I'll follow that by reading a little meditation on death, or rather on all the little deaths that help us see how different and lucky the big death might be. The meditation for practicing dying is taken from the book Broken Open by Elizabeth Lesser, a genuine, intelligent, and wise voice on this topic. First Whitman. A child said, "What is the grass?" fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name some way in the corners, that we may see and remark and say whose. Or I guess the grass is itself a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. Or I guess it is a uniform hieroglyphic, and it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks as among white. Canuck, Tuckahoe, Congressman, Cuff, I give them the same, I receive them the same. And now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. Tenderly will I use you, curling grass. It may be you transpire from the breasts of young men. It may be if I had known them, I would have loved them. It may be you are from old people and from women, and from offspring taken soon out of their mother's laps. And here you are the mother's laps. This grass is very dark to be from the white heads of old mothers, darker than the colorless beards of old men, dark to come from under the faint red roofs of mouths. Oh, I perceive, after all, so many uttering tongues. I perceive they do not come from the roofs of mouths for nothing. I wish I could translate the hints about the dead young men and women, and the hints about old men and mothers, and the offspring taken soon out of their laps. What do you think has become of the young and old men? And what do you think has become of the women and children? They are alive and well somewhere. The smallest sprout shows there is really no death, and if ever there was, it led forward life, and does not wait at the end to arrest it, and ceased the moment life appeared. All goes onward and outward, and nothing collapses, and to die is different from what anyone supposed, and luckier. And next, Elizabeth Lesser. Given the nature of existence, you don't have to wait until something big happens to practice dying. You can begin right now. You can carve out some alone time in your day, sit down, close your eyes, and meditate on the fluid nature of your body, of time, and of life itself. Here is a meditation I use to practice dying. Bring your awareness to focus on something in your life that is changing or ending or dying right now. Breathe gently as you consider whatever transition is most significant right now in your life. Note any feelings that arise: trepidation, excitement, resistance, anger, annoyance, or grief. Every time your feelings get the better of you, become aware of your breathing. Meet your troubled and contracted feelings with your calm and expansive breath. Breathe, sigh, and stretch out on the river of change. Remember times when you have resisted change in the past. Regard how things turned out in the end, maybe not how you thought they would or you wanted them to, but in the end, there you were, wiser, stronger, still alive. Tip your hat to the poignancy of death and the promise of rebirth. Smile, relax, allow yourself to break open. Sit tall with dignity and patience, watching your breath rise and fall. Pray for the courage to welcome this new change with openness and wisdom. Then open your eyes, go back into your life, and do what you have to do, but do it with grace, with hope, and with a lighter touch. That's the meditation. Here's what Elizabeth Lesser has to say about the meditation. I have trained myself now when something is not going my way and I feel rising up within me a big, hard no, to take a breath or two and to counter that no with a different counsel. I tell myself to die to it. Sometimes just saying that little phrase, die to it, is all I need to do to clear my head of the emotional storm clouds. What must die? Any resistance to the bigger truth. Any holding on by that part of me, my little ego part, that cannot see beyond its own nose. If the situation involves another person who appears to be getting in the way of what I want, even if that person is being led around by the nose of his or her own little ego, it is still only necessary for me to die to it. When I can clearly see the whole picture, then I'm free to choose wisely my own next steps. Practicing dying means living as close to reality as we can in each moment. It is the ultimate bravery. The spiritual warrior stands undefended before the truth, not some concept about the truth, but the stripped-down reality of the most mundane, day-to-day situations. When you are arguing with your mate, when you get sick, when you are in a meeting at work, when you confront again for the 100th time the same issue with your parents or child or friend. Every day you are given an embarrassingly rich array of opportunities to die to your resistance to what is so about yourself, your life, and those you share with it. Try it. Next time you are at work and you feel anger rising up to meet a situation that you think is outrageous or unfair or inept, tell yourself to die to it. Take a few meditative breaths and get your little ego out of the way. Size up the whole story, and not just your small piece of it. Take a clean, objective look at what is, and not what you think should be. If you must, walk away from the scene, sit quietly, and practice dying. Ram Dass says that when we practice dying, we are learning to identify less with ego and more with soul. Who would want to be an ego when we can be a soul?
Crossroads that you cannot comprehend. Just remember that death is not the end, and all your dreams have vanished, and you don't know what's up the bend. Just remember that death is not the end, not the end, not the end. Just remember that death is not the end. When the storm clouds gather round you and heavy rains descend, just remember that death is not the end, and there's no one there to comfort you with a helping hand to lend. Just remember that death is not the end, not the end, not the end. Just remember that death is not the end. All the tree of life is growing where the spirit never dies, and the bright light of salvation shines in dark and empty skies. When the cities are on fire with the burning flesh of men, just remember that death is not the end. Remember that death is not the end, not the end, not the end. Just remember that death is not the end, not the end, not the end. Just free.